Hi, and welcome to our podcast, Bodies and Souls, Conversations for the Jewish Woman.
My name is Sarah. I'm a certified teacher and school leader. I'm passionate about education and Torah and Hasidus.
My name is Rifki. I am a certified nurse, midwife, and kala teacher. I am passionate about using our bodies and our innate spiritual abilities to serve Hashem in the most healthy and complete way possible.
Together, we are pleased to present to you Bodies and Souls, fascinating and informative conversations for you, the Jewish woman.
Our aim is to provide you with multidimensional information that will inform and inspire you to be the best version of yourself, supporting your bodies and souls as they strive to be the very best in fulfilling our ultimate potential in bringing Mashiach now. Good morning and welcome to Bodies and Souls, your host for today, Rifki Boyarsky, and I want to welcome Sarah back. Sarah,
thank
so excited
you.
To have you back.
Thank you so much. I am so thrilled, Rifki. I love doing these interviews with you. So this is exciting.
Yes. And today we have a special treat for everyone who's listening. We have Mushka Gupin from Mothering Mindset. Mushka, you know I'm a big fan. We've worked together with the moms at the Motherhood Center, and I love the work that you're doing. I love sharing the work that you're doing. So Mushka, tell whoever doesn't know what you do, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Okay. First of all, thanks for having me here. Okay, my name is Mushka. I have three little kids. The oldest is now six, three boys. And I'm a former high school teacher, and I actually was also a principal. I have a master's in education, and what I do with that master's degree is no longer teach in school, and I teach mothers instead, mostly online and some in person through your, you know, through your groups, how to really parent in the early years. So taking the most advantage of from birth on, so you can give your baby the best start, so you can really like know what you're doing and love what you're doing. Like if mothering is a job, you can learn how to do it. And a lot of it, like I call myself Mothering Mindset, a lot of it is just about perspective. So it's not like a million tips and tricks for you to memorize. It's just like really understanding and getting that mindset reframe or shift. And then, you know, doing like you're the expert on your own baby. So then doing your own thing with your own child.
So for everyone who's listening, Mushka was actually my student. Were you my student? She was my student.
You said that. You were not. You were in the parallel class. So
my Oh, that's so funny. So Mushka, we're going to frame this conversation very much in the line of Pesach and the stress that some people have and the whole Vehigadita, right? So there's so much of Pesach that is so child focused. And so it's supposed to be this really like joyous, uplifting, questioning, knowledge-based, connective holiday. But a lot of people, parents who are juggling a lot of things, do get very caught up in like the minutiae of what we're trying to do. And it becomes a really stressful yantif. So I want to start the conversation just with the Pesach prep. So right now we're all doing Pesach prep and we want our kids to, you know, not resent doing all the jobs that maybe they're not doing the whole year. So talk to us about involving children in housework and work for yantif. And if it's different, you know, different ages, let's specify that as well.
Okay, absolutely. The first thing I want to address is your first point, because I was in the grocery store like last week and I heard a lady say, where's the Pesach aisle? And then I hear her find the aisle and she said, oh, here's where the PTSD is. And that's like you said, we work so hard physically and we prepare so much. We spend so much money. There's a lot invested in Pesach, not just physically, emotionally. Maybe we're getting together with family members or hosting family members. And it's such a shame if we miss the point, like that our kids grow up and they hate it. Like, you know, there's a joke that the carbon Pesach is not your child, like that, you know, and don't go crazy cleaning the chametz and things like that. And this is like, this is a bit of a dramatic example to bring, but I think it's worth putting into the conversation. When Esther asked Mordechai to fast for 3 days, one of those 3 days was the first day of Pesach. And Mordechai said, no, we need to have a Seder. And Esther said, well, if you don't fast this year, there will be no Jews alive to celebrate Pesach next year. So, and then obviously the whole miracle, the story of Purim happened. It's a bit dramatic to say that, but my point here is that like, if you, like we want our kids to grow up and love Pesach and want to do Pesach and look forward to Pesach, and that should be our goal. And having that perspective in mind, even just having that piece in mind, like puts, should help, like can help bring some perspective to what we're doing. Like, why are you working so hard? Why are you cleaning so hard? Why are you going so crazy with the outfits and the clothing and the relatives and the in-laws that are coming or the in-laws that you're going to? Like, it's because Pesach is for the kids. And like you started saying, like, I've been a classroom teacher. Side point, the Seder itself is supposed to be so immersive and so sensory friendly and so conducive to all different kinds of learners, like learners that are auditory. We sing, we talk. Learners that are kinesthetic, that touch things. We do a lot of dipping and physical, manipulating on the Seder table. Learners that are visual, like it's supposed to be a great experience for our kids. And sometimes we can get in the way of that. So that's just one piece to start off with. That's like the mindset piece. Like, how can I make Pesach like that my kids say, oh my God, I can't wait till Pesach next year. And even doing that troubleshooting beforehand, like, if they're already starting to not enjoy the lead up to Pesach, like how can we redirect right now? Like, how can we make it more fun? How could we do that? So one way of doing that is actually involving them in a way that they feel like they're contributing to the household and not that they're being like forced to do things that they don't like that are new tasks or whatever. Like, helping should feel like an honor and a privilege. Like, I get to be involved in what the grownups are doing. I get to contribute. I get to help make Pesach. Like, that's a really good feeling. Like, wow, this stuff that I peeled, I see it going into the kugel. The kugel goes onto the table. Like, is this the kugel that I made? Like, that's the feeling that kids should get. Like, wow, I watched my hands, clean whatever it is, the car, the couch, whatever. And now I get to put a sticker on it that says chametz free or kosher Pesach or check it off on the list. Like, I get to be involved. Like, we want them to be happy. We want them to really take pride and ownership in that. And
can I jump in here, Mishka, on this question, on this idea of having the kids get involved? I love this. And I love how you said that it shouldn't be forced and there should be that excitement of the kids seeing the whole evolution of helping and how it finally comes to fruition when Yom Tov starts. I do wonder, though, about your comments, how it shouldn't be forced. So what does that mean? When the kids are older and they resist helping, we shouldn't force them to help? And I keep on thinking back to my own personal experience. For years and years, we had full-time help in our house, and my kids really didn't need to help because we had so much outside help. And then it was around COVID time. I don't have the full-time help anymore. I have very, very, very little help in my house. And my kids were shocked. We were all shocked. We actually needed to clear the table, wash dishes, figure out how to do laundry, Pesach clean, whatever it is, help make Shabbos. Everyone is now helping. And it's been a struggle. It hasn't been easy. And there has been that element of, no, this is what you do need to do. And I would love to say there's joy. I'm not sure if there's joy. But I do see the children working much harder in my house. So again, I'm trying to figure out what it means when you say that we shouldn't force our kids to help.
Well, it's a good question. And a lot of this depends, like, how old are your kids? What are their dynamics in the house, whether you have help or don't have help? Or, what is a time crunch? If you're working full time and you can only clean for 2 hours a day and you really need the kids to help, right? So two things that I'll talk about, one of them is choices. And one of them is just about maybe like the illusion of choice. So actual choices and then kind of making them feel they have a choice. And here's one piece. And I think this is the piece for us to keep in mind and then go forward from there. They don't, and I know some people will disagree with this. And they might say like, well, I grew up the opposite, or I make my kids do the opposite. And I'm like, that's fine. I think that your kids don't have to help. They don't have to, as in it's not their ultimate responsibility, whether Pesach comes in or not, whether you're ready or not. Like, they're not, you're the adult. That's your job. And should they help? Absolutely. They should be responsible. They should learn life skills. They should learn to be contributing members of the household. You're not their maid. You're not slaving away while they watch videos all day because they're off school for 3 weeks. Like, they should help, but I want you to help. I want you to join me in helping. I want you to contribute to the household. I don't need your help, even if actually you do, because you don't have cleaning help. It's just that that subtle thing that gives children, this is kind of the illusion of choice, because then they feel like they get to opt in. And sometimes you have, especially preteens, and they're like, Mom, not your slave. Don't have to do everything for you. And what they're really saying is like, First of all, on a really practical level, it could just mean I don't understand the task you just assigned to me. It's too overwhelming. I can't physically do it. You interrupted something that I was enjoying, that I was busy doing. You interrupted me to make you do what you want done right now. Also, does it have to get done right now? I remember as I was a kid, when I was a kid, a lot of it was just about like making things seem like they're happening. But like, it doesn't matter if I peel it now or in an hour. My mother just wants to know it's done, so it's off her head. So then I'm going to talk about like giving kids the choices and letting them opt in. But just for us to know as adults, and I say this to my son, and my oldest son is 6. So then people say, oh, you, because your oldest son is 6. Oh no, I taught high school and very difficult high schoolers, boys and girls. So it's true for everyone that, you know, sometimes I say, can you help me do this? And then if I see he doesn't really want to, I say, you don't have to, because you don't. It is his job to play. And anytime I say you don't actually have to do it, he says, okay, I can actually do it. I'll help you, mommy, sure, because he's not feeling forced into it. And so it's okay to give the kids responsibilities around their house. And also just keeping in mind that, like, thank you, because ultimately they are contributing. And you don't have to fall over yourself thanking them every single time they peel a single potato. But thank you for helping contribute to the household. That's like the sentiment. Again, because I'm the adult and it's my job to make sure Pesach happens. And because you live here, you do have to contribute to the household. So thank you for your contribution to it. We are all a team effort and we're all making this happen. Already kind of this team element is already like, I can buy into that. I can like think about a company where you have a boss barking orders, or where the culture is where like we value all our employees and we treat you out to lunch randomly sometimes, or we just thank you and we acknowledge and appreciate you. Like, this is the culture of your home and you're the CEO of your home. You're running this company. And you value all your employees who are your kids that are not getting paid. But, you know, just that's kind of more of like the illusion of choice, because ultimately they do have to, especially if they're a little older and you say like, you have to, you're 15. This is why you're off of school. You got to just do this. But then we can talk about some actual choices that they can actually really opt into. And again, feel that ownership and that, autonomy because they chose it. So I'll talk about that.
I love that. Mushka. So I actually, for everyone who's listening, I know that you might be thinking, oh, Mushka has really young kids and she might not actually know what she's, you know, but I think if you listen to Dina Gorkin's episode, Dina actually touches on a lot of these things, maybe from a slightly different angle, but she talks about the fact that sometimes we have to tell teenagers, you're part of this partnership, you're part of this great big thing that we enterprise that we call a family. And yes, there are certain obligations. And I actually want to just share something, an idea someone just told me. I like to ask my older friends who are like, are done raising their children about like, you know, challenges, because, you know, Pesach can be a challenge to get everyone to feel good about it. And one of my older friends shared that what she did when her kids were, you know, we're not talking 8 and under, we're not even talking 10 and under, we're definitely talking like teenagers and preteens, is she would get a stack of ones. And she would tell the kids every single morning, I'm putting out this, you know, this list of what our family's obligations are. Take 2 jobs, take 3 jobs. It has to be done by a certain time. And she would, at random, not all day long, at random, hand out ones. And she said it motivated everyone and made everyone feel good. And at the end, they had some, you know, extra money. It wasn't that they were getting paid for helping. It was like a bonus, you know, like what you're talking about, like giving your kid a little bit of a bonus. So I think that just making it work for your dynamic is very important, right? So it's not one size fits all. The other thing is that if you heard Mushka say that we're not forcing our kids to help, I think that we're not forcing them, like we're not standing with a gun and saying you better help, but there are obligations that kids have towards a family and we have to recognize that, right? Your obligation is that you are home and you are helping.
Well, even on a not Pesach day, when you take off your clothing, you need to put it in the hamper. My 2-year-old does that. And you need to put your shoes where they belong so we can get dressed in the morning. And if my 6-year-old wants to bring Nagavasser so he can check it off his chart, then you are in charge of remembering it, filling it up, and then I'm dumping it back out in the morning. So a lot of this is not, this is more just like, you need to be a functional person in society and our household has to run. And it just gets amped up because on Pesach, there's tons of new jobs that are, you know, time sensitive and time specific. And a lot of that is cooking, or cleaning that is like extra cleaning. But in general, yes, each person has to contribute to the household in a certain way. And then when we get into a, like if you were planning super fun, like a birthday party, a surprise birthday party for someone, like maybe you were planning it for the father or for the sibling, everyone would have a job for the birthday party too. And because this is like a one-time specific, has an expiration date and involves a few more jobs, for example. And a birthday party is a lot of fun and there's a lot of hype built up. Pesach is a little extended. There's a lot more jobs. It's not as much fun, but it's still like a one-time when we need all hands on deck and we need everyone to pitch in. That's, I think, what Sarah was saying. Like, she's like, I do need all my kids to be involved and I do need all hands on deck. Like, that's fine. This is a specific time when we need all hands on deck. And this is when the different job lists will come in. Because, right. But it's again, but it's about reframing it. Like, I don't, and this, I think kids really, really sense it. And this is why you have kids who say, I'm not your cleaning lady. Oh, I hate this. And they're really communicating, like, I don't feel valued. I don't understand what I'm doing. I'm not sure why we're doing this. It feels really forced. It feels really pressure. Again, it could be a kid that, like, I literally don't understand what you're telling me to do when you say, like, go clean my room. But if it had, like, a specific checklist and broke the task more, this is more like executive functioning. And then we say, well, I'm not your maid either, because like we're stressed out and we're overwhelmed, but they're really communicating something. So that's why I said we're starting with this mindset of this piece of like, of what, however it helps you to think about it. Maybe it's the company culture of your home and you're the CEO. Maybe it's that you're a team and you're all on at a boat at sea and you all have to get to shore together. Like whatever it is, like we all have to be a team together. And just this shift can make a lot of the resistance go away and can also make it be a lot more fun for the kids. Again, I'm kind of speaking to kids who like my 6-year-old doesn't have any real jobs, right? I literally don't rely on him. But especially if you have kids who are a little bit older than that, then really communicating this piece. But let me share some ideas of ways to give choices from younger kids to older kids, because that also helps them feel like really proud of their end result because it's something that they chose. And the most obvious one is to make a list and give them a choice, but then it has to be a real choice. And the thing is, like, I remember my job used to be like wiping down the fridge, and that's like gross. I hate doing it until today. But I'm more than happy to do something else that maybe other people think is gross. So like, if your kid is saying, ew, I don't want to do this, but I will do this, like, okay, fine. Then let them do it. Like actually let them, like, if you're going to, it has to be a real choice. Like if you don't want to clean the couch, you don't have to. And you want to unload the dishwasher or whatever it is, right? You could do that instead. And you can make it really fun and really visual. Like if there was a list, they can, like a huge list, they can check it off. A huge whiteboard, they can label stickers all over the house, like, you know, Yossi and label style. This was done, this was chametz free. That makes it, gives a lot of like immediate visual feedback. Like I can look around and like see what has to, you know, what I actually accomplished. And I also think that like it's in the moment when you call requests out randomly, like you remember something that needs to be done and then you start saying, oh, kid number one, can you go do this? Kid number two, can you go do that? I think that's what like throws kids off, because like they are busy playing. That is their job as kids, or they're just busy or they're doing something else. And that's like not really a choice. So like a step before that, which would be on us, is to be a little bit more organized and try to think through the things that would have to happen, like not remembering in the middle of your soup or your kugel that you need more vegetables peeled for it. Or saying like, I need this done, but it doesn't have to be the second, right? You can finish up what you're doing. Again, that's kind of like more the illusion of choice where like, I'm going to ask you to help me anyways, but like you can choose whether you want to do it now or whether you want to do it in an hour. And we can also be really playful. It doesn't have to be so harsh. It could be a lot of fun. In general, any injecting playfulness always works from all ages, especially if it's something that is not fun. So you could be, and oh, the psychology of this is that if you take something, if you do it the same way, but you do it playfully. So let's say they say, oh, you're barking out orders. You say, yes, I am. I am pari. I am so mean. And if I see any Jew still hanging out in this kitchen after the next order, I am going to start screaming my special pari scream. On the count of three, everybody get out and go do the job I just gave you. And like, you know, whatever, like that's, you could be pari barking out orders, time them to see how long it takes. With this time, it depends on the age of the kid. Maybe they can track it. They can trade it in for screen time. They can trade it in for a dollar or cents, like money. They could trade it in with quality time for you. They can just trade it in and see who's the winner of who got the most timed tasks. This is great for like when you're in the middle of the cooking and you're like, oh my God, I need another two potatoes. Which kid should I bother right now to ask me? Like, this is like, who wants to win the time of this one, right? You can make races between
kids. We're not bothering our kids. We're not bothering our kids, Mushka. It's not a bother.
No, it's not a bother. No, I'm thinking of like, I'm just trying to anticipate like what would resistance, where would resistance come from? Right.
Oh, they're going to feel bothered. Got it. Yeah. That they're going to feel bothered. Yeah.
Yeah, if they do. Yeah, no, you're allowed to, I mean, you're the mother, you run the house. You don't have to be scared of your kids. No, I'm anticipating like, I know I'm kind of picking on this point, but we can move to a different one, which is like, why would kids feel like, why would they feel like they're being bothered, right?
I totally hear that though. I think that that's a very, very valid point that the kids do feel bothered when we're interrupting, and they're expecting to have downtime, right? They're expecting to be able to, you know, run outside or read a book or, yeah, I get it.
It's also because the time is so unstructured. If you have older kids who are home from school and you're like, okay, I need you to help. And then it's like, well, what do you need me to do exactly? And even if, you know, when I remember being in second grade and the second grade teacher had a list of like all the work we were doing that day, there was like, let's say an hour of quiet time. And you had to do like math page 30 and English page 15. And it was quiet time and everyone had to do whatever they had to do. And then when you finished all your work in whichever order you wanted to do it, you can like choose a book or a puzzle, whatever. And that was like, I was in second grade. And I still remember the feeling of like, I can choose which work I want to do when, like, it's all going to get done in the next hour, but I can choose it. So giving your kids, especially ones that are home from school, this element of like planning your day, and you say like, here are all the jobs that have to be done today. Choose the job. This job is time sensitive, has to be done by 3 p.m. This one you can do at any time. You can, you know, as long as you tick things off your list and it happens the way it needs to be happen, like, you don't have to micromanage them. They could really feel in control of their day. They could plan to go out with their friends in between. So that is also like another strategy. Again, these are kind of older
kids. Thank you. Mushka, these are really, really important strategies. Thank you for sharing them with us. I kind of want to circle back to the idea of not forcing your kids to do chores. I know Rifki brought it up and I want to bring it up too. I think about how when my full-time help left and then it was a shock to our system and everybody has to pitch in and do chores and take a share in running the house. It was the healthiest thing that happened to us as a family. And I have not ever looked back at bringing in the full-time help again. In fact, I was reading up about it and Michelle Borba, I don't know if you know of her, she's a specialist in building character development in kids. She speaks about how when a child does chores in the house, it's one of the strongest indicators of being a functional member of society and being successful in the 21st century. Chores are not just, oh, you have an overwhelmed mother trying to make Pesach. They teach many other skills as well. And I saw for my family, for my older children, who I don't want to go there, but there was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of unhappiness going on, feet shuffling. I would much rather, who wouldn't rather put their feet up on the couch and not have to get up and get involved and, you know, work. But ultimately, what we do see is a lot of discipline and other important skills that we're thrilled that are taking place in our personal family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do Montessori really from birth, and I have my babies and my toddlers like peeling their food, chopping their food, serving salad to themselves, cleaning up after themselves. And it looks like they're like working very hard, but especially the younger the kids are. First of all, younger kids, especially toddlers, love it. It's a whole developmental stage where they just love doing, being involved in real life. Montessori calls it practical life because it's practical life. So I'm a big fan of kids really owning like two areas, like self-care, like taking care of their bodies. That means their stuff and their belongings and their things like that. And then just skills that are, and then usually just like cooking skills and things that help, like family household skills. So that's like laundry or cooking or kind of those areas. So again, this is just about being a contributing member of the household at any age. I just feel like it's amped up because of our own anxiety or stress or urgency around Pesach, because we're not really doing laundry. We're not really, you know, cleaning up after our regular meals. We're adding in all these extra cleaning that doesn't usually happen. And all this extra, a lot of people throw in spring cleaning too. So all of a sudden you're organizing closets to find your summer clothing, which is not Pesach cleaning, and making kids try on clothing and sorting things out and having them schlep things, whatever, you know, depends on the age of the kid. And that's where it can get tricky of like, why is Pesach specifically such a high pressure time in my house? So taking away that pressure and leaving in all the skills for sure, even when kids help in the kitchen. And the thing about Pesach specifically is just peels, because usually like they can do whatever, however they want to do it, and then it doesn't matter. But if you're particular about peels on Pesach or about things like that, and then the little kid comes in, and here's a, like a rule of thumb, whenever a kid asks to help, say yes, whatever age. And don't say, oh, no, this, unless the knife is too sharp, because a lot of people's Pesach knives are very sharp. Okay. They want to peel? Sure, you can peel. You want to help cut? Sure, you can cut. Never turn down an offer of help. And you don't have to use what they're doing, although I suggest you do use what they're doing. It's a big deal if they can put their own salad bowl on the table, on the kids' table. It could go to the kids' table and they can say, oh, this is a salad that I cut. And don't redo their work. That's one thing out of any age of child. If you're going to redo their work, don't make me do the job in the first place. If you could have done it better than I, you didn't need me. And that's just busy work. I like literally at any age, even as a teacher, like never give kids busy work. But if you're going to have a little kid help you peel, let's say, you can explain beforehand, like I might check your, like it's Pesach. We're really careful about peels. Mommy might help you peel after whatever. But otherwise don't show them that you're going to redo it. That's just, I'm just picking up on you were saying like your kids thrive so much from being allowed to participate in the house and from working, and they learned their place and they learned all these skills and things like that. Absolutely. And just in terms of Pesach, like you said, it was a shock to the family. So easing them into it so that it's not such, I mean, I think year round kids should have responsibilities, but again, it's like, I don't need you to clean up after yourselves. I want you to learn how to clean up after yourselves. Because I want you to learn that. It's important for you to learn that. Yeah, I think it's just, that was the first thing I said.
So it is important to teach our kids life skills. And I love that we're reframing it that way, that it's not just, you know, I can't handle it without you and it's a big stress, but it's, we're all a team and we're all doing this. Let's move past the Pesach cleaning and past the Pesach prep and move a little bit more towards the Seder. Now, we do have an obligation as parents to make the Seder something that the kids ask questions and the kids feel involved in, the kids have food for thought and they're able to share. As parents, how do we involve our children into the Seder and so they feel that this is their Seder rather than they're at a Seder where they're forced to participate?
This is such a good question. I have a whole resource on this. I usually post it on Instagram. I'll make it available on my site because it's, you know why? Because a lot of people can run the marathon and then you sit down at Seder night and you're like, okay, now what? Now can I just crash and go to sleep? But actually all that preparation was supposed to be for this moment. And, you know, to take advantage of the night. One really easy way to do it is here's the thing also as adults, like a lot, this might be more of like a guy thing where you might have to communicate this to whoever's leading the Seder. This is not their night to shine and to tell stories and to look like like that picture perfect cover illustration of, you know, the bearded grandfather or whatever leading this beautiful Seder. Like it's not your night. It should be the night of the children. And the other thing is that if we can structure the Seder so that either we kind of do, maybe we do kids, it depends on the age of the kids. So if you have really little kids and you want to do like a kids magid maybe beforehand so they can actually go to bed possibly, or when you get to real magid, you do give the kids attention and then let the men sit and discuss the whole night long. So just like reminding the adults that like we have to, like, let's all be on the same page as much as we can. And I know family dynamics will play into this, of letting the kids be the stars of the show. If you have teenagers, then like the same thing, like they learn stuff in school. Like, what do you think they've been doing all month? Like let them lead the Haggadah, let them lead Magid, let them share the Divrei Torah that they learned. And we can even take a step back and say, come back to actually setting the Seder table. So actually setting the table. First of all, the kids can set the table. They can load it with their Haggadahs and their crafts. They can load it with their toys, and set out horses and little, you know, little menchies and little people. And it doesn't have to be crazy. Like, you have these toys in your house if you have kids, right? You have a few animals and you have a few people, and put it on the table. You can bring to the Seder table a lot of cushions and blankets and pillows. Let the kids crash and hang out on the floor. Bring the books to the Seder table. It depends, maybe the couch is right next to your table, but if it's not, letting them kind of participate in the Seder, but not really. Like, they have downtime, they're allowed to leave the table. Another thing is, they don't have to sit through the whole thing. That's not the point. Let them come in and out. Let them come to the cool parts. Like, Karpas is really cool, and then some parts are really boring for them. Like, that's okay. You can dip in and out of the Seder. You don't have to sit the whole night. Even a teenager, you can dip in and out of the Seder. Like, it's, that's my thing. That's what I wouldn't, or maybe you have a young bacher, maybe, but otherwise, like, let them come in and out. And the girls, you're going to need their help in the kitchen anyways. And also, like, expecting that you may not read every word of the Haggadah right now, but that's okay. You could read it later. And you might be more focused on the kids. It really depends on the age of the kids and how many kids you have. But that's what the Seder can look like, where it's more of like, and the way the Seder, the Haggadah, is designed to be child-led. It's just sometimes we do all the reading for them. It's designed that they're supposed to, it's like an amazing lesson, like anyone who's teaching. Like, it's not a frontal lesson. It starts off with the kids asking questions. We do all these interactive things, and it's supposed to be really hands-on for them. And, like, sometimes we just kind of miss the point. And one thing before this, even before the Seder, is setting everyone up for success. So, like, obviously we know the kids have to take naps, but you also should take a nap, and the kids should eat supper before the Seder begins, because Shulchan Aruch is way too late. Everyone has to eat real food, including you, and everyone has to drink, including you. And if they set the table, don't redo it. Let it be the kids' table. It's okay if it's gross. They're the ones sitting there anyways, right? And let them come in pajamas. Or, you know, don't put them on that new white outfit that you're going to get so anxious that they spilled grape juice on. Like, that is not, save it for when people can actually see them in shul tomorrow. Like, let them wear pajamas or comfortable clothing. Let them bring their, you know, their crafts to the table. And don't come to the table ready to fall asleep, like, which is really, but what can really happen unless we're pretty intentional about it.
Really nice tips. Talking about another obstacle, I think the length of the Seder really can be an obstacle, especially for kids to stay engaged and active.
I think this, it comes back to the picture on the Haggadah. Like, think about what your Shabbos table looks like. If, like, what does a typical Shabbos table look like? In my house, like, I barely even cook for Shabbos day. I'm like, all the kids are going to eat is challah and salad, done. You know, like, I don't, we're not having, and maybe tell it later. We're not having huge meals. We're not having huge spreads. We eat the food. We go to the park. We go visit cousins. We play. Like, we don't have a Shabbos meal on Shabbos day, because that's the age and stage of my kids. So it's like the Seder is like that, but just like times 100. Like, you're not getting this picture perfect experience. No one is going to sing along nicely. There's definitely going to be a baby crying at some point. Someone is absolutely going to spill grape juice within the first 5 minutes. And if you, like, slaved away over the food, like, by the time you serve it, no one's touching it. Like, just understand that this is real life. Everyone is real humans. The kids are real kids. And coming back to, like, what is the point of tonight? The point of tonight is that the kids should say next year, oh my God, I can't wait for the Seder. That's it. What do you need? What do your kids need? What does your house need to do for your specific kids to be able to say that next year? That, like, if you did that, that's it. That's the whole point of tonight. Because here's what I feel like, this is a teacher in me, but the point of the Seder is to transmit the heritage. That's literally the point. We left Mitzrayim to become a nation, but he got it to Levencha. I'm telling it to you, so you should tell it to your kids. Like, if you want your kids to love Pesach and sit at their own Seder table one day, giving it over to their own kids, and not be that lady in the grocery store who associated the potato starch with PTSD, like, then it will look different in every house, but how can you make your Seder just really happy and enjoyable for the kids? And reading the Haggadah, I was shocked to discover this as an adult, takes 10 minutes. I didn't realize, because as a kid, it took forever. And then, what, you know, 1 year I had to, probably the first year I was nursing the baby or whatever, it took 10 minutes to finish the Haggadah. And I was like, that's it? Like, it's not a big deal to catch it up later as an adult. You don't have to sit over Maggid for 10 hours if you have antsy kids, skip straight to the Afikoman and finish it later. Like, I don't know, some, especially people who like have been to Chabad seders, like Chabad house seders or run a Chabad house seder, like it's pretty obvious that like you cater to the guests and you catch up your own seder later. But like, why is the Chabad house guest more special or more important than my little children? They both equally need to have an enjoyable Pesach. And maybe I have more obligation to my kids, like if I'm not running a Chabad house seder. So like that same mentality, like we want it to have a really good experience. We want everyone who's here to come back next year. And through that lens, like what has to happen for your kids or for your family or for your table to make that happen?
It's such an important point, which is making the seder really work for ages and stages. And I, Mushka, like you, for many, many years, like I left the seder in the middle. And that's why I always made sure we never did the seder alone, right? Because if I left the table, then there would be a vacuum. Like we always did with my parents or my siblings or my husband's siblings. You know, there was always other adults there to continue, you know, with the energy of the seder. The only thing I will say is that as kids do get older, they do want to have some sort of, I don't want to say picture perfect, but something that's much more resembling the picture in the front of the Agada, right? This is the Masaira that we have, that we do sit for hours and hours, and we do speak about the, you know, Yetzias Mitzrayim, and we speak about all the Mefarshim. And I know my boys are getting older and they want to talk about all the different opinions and they want to argue with it and they want to discuss it. And my three-year-old's not interested, right? So like there's an element of juggling that sometimes goes in, because that picture perfect Seder definitely does not work and did not work for very many years for when my kids were little. But now my kids are older and they want that, right? They want to be part of that really long, drawn out Seder. So probably this year, I have a three-year-old, I will probably go up and put him to bed and say, you know, say the rest of the Haggadah quickly. But I will hopefully be able to come back down and join them and listen to my kids, you know, sit there and argue with my father and my brother and like, see, you know, no, I heard this, there was another opinion, and there's value. There's a lot of value to that. So I think that it's all about, everyone has what to say.
We all have what to say. It's such a great point. But it's still child-led what you're describing. The older kids want something, you're following their lead, you're giving them the environment they're requesting for, that they're developmentally and cognitively and emotionally and maturity-wise ready for. And the three-year-old's not.
I think that's the point. The point is that a lot of times we're juggling different ages and stages, and that picture perfect is usually the older, it's usually geared toward the older boys and girls, like the teenagers and the young adults, right? But when you're juggling both, I think there's value to both. So we're not totally like saying, oh no, that isn't, you know, really how Seder has to be with little kids, but sometimes it is like that, and that's okay also.
I'm just trying to figure out what picture in the Haggadah everyone's talking about, because the picture I'm envisioning is one where there's crystal and glasses. I wasn't even thinking about how long the Seder is taking and who's speaking.
Oh, they're all very well behaved in the picture. They're all very well behaved in the picture.
I want to push back a little bit. I want to say that some parents are more formal. Some parents want a formal Shabbos table and a formal Pesach table, no matter the age of their children. And they insist that the children comply with the standards or the expectations that they appreciate. Whereas some parents perhaps feel there's no reason for this. My kids are so young. Let's wait till they get older.
Right. And I think that also, Mushka, this plays into one of the comments that you said, like have your kids wear pajamas at the table. I cannot imagine allowing my children to wear pajamas at the Seder. Like we are all supposed to be dressed like we're coming out of Mitzrayim, right? We're all supposed to be in our shirt. I literally will buy an extra outfit for Pesach that I don't buy for the winter, because I know the Seder, they need that third outfit. They, even if it's a 2-day yantif, they will have that third outfit so that they could be in clothes that I don't care if it spills. Like to me, I don't care. It's full of grape juice at the end of the night. They wore a Shabbat outfit at the table. Then they will probably, 3/4 of them will fall asleep in that.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm going to come back to the first thing I started off saying, which is like, I'm not here to tell you what to do. It would be impossible. You have, especially Pesach night, it's like we all have our Messiah. We have different, all of a sudden, the great grandfather who's Yemenite, his traditions get whipped out, right? So it's very much cultural. It's super, super cultural, down to like your individual family culture, even more than just like being Lubavitch or being from whatever. So I'm not telling you what to do. I think that I'm giving different suggestions, ideas, whatever things you're allowed to push back on it, right? The first thing I want to do is just offer a different perspective. And then you're like, okay, this does or doesn't work for me. I do or don't agree with it. It's just a different way of seeing things. So both of you are right. I mean, you're not wrong. It's totally cultural. Like, so sorry, you're saying like, what if a family is more formal? Rifki can't imagine pajamas. Rifki, because you have big boys. I don't. I have little boys. I bought them Seder night pajamas. So you see, that's how you did the opposite. You want them to be super dressed up and super feel the Seder. And that's totally valid. And I want my kids to conk out at the Seder table. And that's also valid. It doesn't matter. It's coming from the same place of like, how can they be involved to the maximum, again, age, maturity level, developmental level, according to their age stage and how it's supposed to, or how I want it to look like in my family. You're building your own family too, even though it's a multi-generational table usually, or ideally, or hopefully, or right on the picture of the Haggadah. You are creating your own traditions for your own kids. And then Sarah, you were saying, what if the family is more formal? It, again, the only thing I would say about that is, are your kids on board with it? As in like, I've been to really formal, like Friday night meals, let's say, where the parent says every single person must sit around this table, the entire Friday night meal. And the kids say, well, they don't listen. And they just wanted to be at the table, you know, they wanted to escape to the couch with books or whatever. And so like, it's just like, kind of like, how much are you in touch with reality a little bit, meaning the reality of your kids and how much they can take and how much they're willing to go along with you. But if you wanted to have a more formal table because Zadie's at the table or Saba or whoever's leading the table, and we want it to be a certain way, like, okay, maybe that's how Seder is run in your house, right? But just make sure the kids are on board with it, because the whole point of this is that the Seder is for the kids. That's basically it. So making sure that, you know.
Mushka, I appreciate the fact that what you're doing is you're taking a lot of pressure off a lot of women in the world. You're saying it's okay. It's okay if it's not like the, if you want it to be that way and your kids are happy and your whole family is happy, you have the resources, go for it. But if you can't manage and it needs to be look differently, that's also okay. And honestly, Pesach pajamas are a lot cheaper than Pesach outfits. A lot. Brilliant idea.
There's something really interesting about Seder and Pesach in general. Most people have only celebrated it in their own families. Even if you get married and you have a culture shock from your husband's family, it's still within family. Most people have not been to other houses the way that we go to other houses, Shabbos meals. So you end up in this bubble of what Seder is supposed to look like, or because that's how I saw my grandfather and then my father do it and my uncles will do the same thing. My marriage to my husband's family and that's how they do it. You don't get the experience of how tons of different Jews lead Seder. And the truth is that just like everyone's Shabbos table looks different, everyone's Seder's table is going to look different. And even people who use I remember going to my cousins who are shluchim in a different country, and they don't use any products, just like we don't use any products, but somehow her dishes were completely different. Using the same no products, she had a totally different menu. And it's just like using the same basic ingredients, like here's one ingredient, Seder night, here's another ingredient, Haggadah. How it looks so different. The recipe turns out different in every family because of because of the components of the family and that dynamic that kind of makes that recipe for Seder night. So yes, if you do kind of get stuck in your little bubble of like, but my kids are supposed to wear beautiful clothing, but how? My oldest kid is 3 and I have a nursing newborn. Then it's like, no, they, you know, you're allowed to kind of make it work for your age and your stage, or the opposite. But my kids are getting so much older, and all of a sudden I have to start leading a grown-up Seder for them because they learned about it in school and they're asking for it. Then like, yes, your family is graduating into an older family stage. And that's also valid and going to be beautiful and going to be your own experience.
So I think that one of the things we kind of like went very slowly by was a multi-generational Pesach Seder. So a lot of people who are listening are going to either be going to someone else's house or having older family members or older people at their Seder who might be expecting something else that the kids are not used to. So it's very easy to tell parents who are in control of their Seder, you know, let's have a very child-led Seder. But what if you're going to your parents or your in-laws or your grandparents or an older relative who is running their Seder totally differently. Your kids don't have the time to shine. They don't have space at the table for it to be kid-friendly. How does a mother listening make sure that her child has the time and has the ability to really feel good about their Seder experience?
I mean, you might have the same question where, like, maybe your husband is going to lead the Seder in a way that you don't agree with, but too bad. Like, this kind of comes down to, number one, communication. How much, because Bubbies and Zadies, like, they don't want any kids screaming at the table. They just don't. They forgot what it's like, and they really don't want to be reminded of it. So one thing you can start off with is just, like, you know, maybe we can, like, heads up, I'm probably going to have to take my kids out to bed early. Like, can we communicate this? Can we make it happen? Are you okay? If, like, just whoever house you're in, kind of communicating about the house rules or expectations. But also, again, like, Seder is just times 100. But what happens on Friday night when your kids come home with the Parsha sheet? Do you actually read it on Friday night? Do you maybe read it Shabbos morning, the Parsha sheet with them? Maybe you read it at the Shabbos afternoon meal. Maybe you don't really read it on Shabbos at all, but you read it Friday right when they come home. Like, these are all different ways of, like, it's not ideal. It's not perfect, maybe the way we want it to be, but they can say the Manish Dana to Zadie over breakfast the next day. They could say it to your husband separately before he goes to shul, possibly if he has time. You can make your own family tiny little Seder during supper, which you should be feeding them supper anyways, right? At like 5 p.m. or like before the 10 o'clock Seder. So maybe they can read their Manish Dana and whatever during your family supper right then. So it, kind of these different ways of, like, I mean, look, if you're going to someone's Seder, this is not the first time you've dealt with them probably. And the first time this has come up probably. It's just, again, everything is maximized by Pesach, but it really kind of comes down to maybe different communication, a lot of adjusting expectations. And the other thing is communicating it to the kids, because especially a little kid, they might be like, but Mora said I have to ask the Manish Dana to Tati. And it's like, okay, well, at the Seder, Zadie leads the Seder, and you're going to ask Tati the Manish Dana later, whatever, you know, whatever the different dynamics look like. And that's okay. In real life, we have to deal with our family members and we love to spend time with them, even though it can be a stressful time over Pesach. But that's why we're getting together with them. And the other part of it is not just the kid-led Seder, it's also the transmission. I really believe, and I expose my kids a lot because thank God I have my own grandparents, so they have great grandparents. We get exposed to, you know, our Bubbies and Zadies, our elder Bubbies and Zadies, our great grandparents. Even if you can't really communicate with them or don't understand them or think they're boring, like, you need to be exposed to them in real life. So especially if you're lucky enough to be at a guest that your kids have their great grandparents or their grandparents there, it's okay for them to kind of be quiet and listen also, and give them their shiny moment, possibly in a different way. There's huge value in that intergenerational family as well.
So I want to share a story as we get towards the wrapping up about the Seder that really made me, like, do a shift in how I thought about the Seder. I grew up in a very formal home, right? So Seder was Seder. I mean, like, my grandparents would have, like, place cards, and the Dvar Torahs were, like, picked in advance. You know, there was, like, we knew what food was expecting. We knew which grandchild was saying which Dvar Torah at what point. Like, everything was very much set. Like, there were crystals. We were not allowed to leave the table. Like, it was extremely formal. And for years, like, we went back and forth. Like, one Pesach, I brought my children to my step-grandmother's home. My grandfather at this point already passed, but some of his friends were still coming with their wives to the Seder. And there was an old man who wrote a fabulous book, and I'm going to link it in the show notes. His name is Martin Judovitz. Martin is a big Talmud Chacham, was, Olav HaShalom, was a very beautiful person. And one of the things that he would do at the Seder was share a story of his life, you know, as he was running away from the Nazis and the Holocaust. And I remember, like, in this very, very formal, like, he had a place where he would do it. And every year was the same story, and my kids got to hear it. And it was typed up, and we knew when to expect it. And I was sitting at this poolside Seder table. There were glasses, and it was color coordinated. It was matching. It was gorgeous. It was prettier than a picture in the Agada. And I literally had four kids having a meltdown at the same time. I could tell you that I was covered in sweat because I was like, we're disrupting this beautiful Seder that, like, and he turned around and he stopped. Like, at this point, he was the oldest person at the Seder. And he stopped and he turned to me and he said, Rifki, this is exactly what we're supposed to do. And he called two of my kids to him, put them on his lap. And he's like, what do you want right now? And he sat there, stopped the Seder. And it was like such a lesson to me that like, it doesn't make a difference. Really, really, it doesn't make a difference. And he turned to me afterwards. He said, Rivki, this is all we need as Yiddish people. He lost everything. He lost so much. And he said, this is it. This is where it's at. And I don't want to like put like a negative spin, maybe like we're, you know, focusing on what we lost and what could have been and what should have been generationally, but we're celebrating our freedom as a nation, and our children are our freedom. Our children are what keeps us going. And it was such a moment for me where it was like a paradigm shift. Like, obviously it wasn't about, you know, the kids behaving. It was about the kids gaining and growing and being and connecting. And I think that that's the message, Mushka, that you're giving us so, so strongly, that it isn't about the things and it isn't about checking, you know, what you've done correctly at your Seder, but it's about giving the kids the love and the connection to Yiddishkeit and really giving them the ownership of their portion of the Seder. And Seder really, and Pesach really is about transmitting our tradition and our story to the next generation.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. I got chills listening because like, yeah, that is the point. You know, the point is it's both. It's to have that elderly person there and to have the future, you know, that to have the link to the past. It's very much a link to the past, and it's also the connection to the future. And it's on it will be on us as that link to the past to bring it into the future, and the future is our kids. But you need both elements.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but Mushka, Rivki and I really want to thank you. Your strategy, your focus is a child-centered approach. It's so important to be reminded of this as we get swept away in all of the preparation. Who are we doing this for? Who's at the center of our work? And I hear your voice over and over as we talk about helping, as we talk about the Seder meals, we talk about the whole environment of Yom Tov. You keep on reminding us that it's the children that have to be our focus. And I want to thank you for that. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and Rivki, and on behalf of all of our listeners. Keep up the good work that you're doing. And if our listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they?
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun to have this conversation. I hope it does indeed reach some frazzled young or even older mom in the midst of her Pesach preparations. I'm on Instagram. My handle is at Mothering Mindset. My site is mymotheringmindset.com. And there's a few resources up in there for you as well. And that's where you can find me at. You can sign up for my emails there. I send weekly emails, mostly full of kind of these different perspective shifts. No tips and tricks, just different things for you to think about, incorporate, and then apply to your own life and your own parenting. So it works for your own kids and your own family.
And we're going to put all that down in the show notes so that you just have to click and you'll go right to Mushka's information and resources, which are plentiful and not just Pesach related. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed and grew. Original music of Shamil's Niggun provided by Chazan David Katak.
We look forward to your input, feedback, and suggestions. We also have partnership opportunities available. Please email info@bodiessouls.com. Again, info@bodiessouls.com with two S's. Thank you. Thank you.